Today at Reader's Corner, author and journalist Maren McKenna talking about the growing threat to human health posed by antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
The very first discoverers understood that antibiotics contained within themselves the seeds of their own destruction, because almost all of us have only lived within the antibiotic era. We don't understand the way in which antibiotics really changed the world. The problem now is that bacteria's inventiveness has not diminished, but we, for various reasons, are running out of drugs. There are signs all around that this trust that we've put in antibiotics to hold up the structure of modern society ought to start fraying. We really are at the edge of a post-antibiotic era.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Antibiotics are ubiquitous in modern human life. Along with their well-known medical applications, they also are routinely used in agriculture, including our increasingly industrial production of meat. But as resistant strains of bacteria continue to emerge, health authorities around the world are growing alarmed at the increasing impotence of antibiotics to fight disease. In fact, they worry we are on the verge of a total breakdown in the overall usefulness of these drugs. It's a scenario of horrifying scope to those who understand the implications for human health. Journalist and author Maren McKenna has covered this looming disaster for magazines and websites like Wired, Scientific American, Medium, Slate, Modern Farmer, Nature, The Atlantic, and The Guardian. She is the author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA, Beating Back the Devil on the Front Lines with the Disease Detectives of the Epidemic Intelligence Service. Ms. McKenna is currently writing a book about the entwined histories of antibiotic development in agriculture for National Geographic. Links to much of her work can be found at her website at marynmckenna.com, and Maren is spelled M-A-R-Y-N. Ms. McKenna is a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University and a research fellow in the Knight Science Journalism Program at MIT. She teaches science writing in the United States and Asia. Ms. McKenna joins us today by phone for this interview. Maren McKenna, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Maren, let's start with the gentleman who really was the discoverer of penicillin, Sir Alexander Fleming. When he accepted the Nobel Prize in 1945, he gave us a bit of a warning, didn't he?
He did, and I find this story so striking because it lets us know that right from the very beginning of the antibiotic era, the very first discoverers understood that antibiotics contained within themselves the seeds of their own destruction. So just to remind your listeners, Fleming's first identification of what we came to know as penicillin was in 1928. He was a Scot. He was working in a laboratory at a hospital in London, St. Mary's Hospital. And he left a window open in his lab, and something apparently blew in across his culture plates. It happened that he was growing staph on those culture plates. And again, 1928, they didn't really have plastics yet. So the plates were glass. And a time came a couple of weeks later when they needed to reclaim them to grow some new bacterial cultures. So he picked up one of the staph plates. And when staph is grown in culture, it looks like what they call a lawn, like a lawn of grass. It should flow from edge to edge of the plate. But on this particular plate, there were little spots where the staph had died. And when he looked in those individual spots, he realized that at the center of each one was a tiny speck of what turned out to be penicillium mold. And from that discovery flowed our first useful penicillin in the early 1940s. So it took a while for penicillin to get developed into a drug. It was rolled out on the battlefields of World War II in 1943. By 1945, it had changed the world. And Fleming and his co-developers were awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine. And when he gave his speech, he said, "We need to be careful because it will happen that ignorant people will underdose or overdose themselves. They will misuse these drugs, and bacteria will learn how to defend themselves." And he was so correct that only 2 years later, an epidemic of penicillin-resistant staph began to move across the globe. And that started what was effectively a game of leapfrog that we've been engaged in ever since with bacteria, in which they become resistant, we come up with a new drug, they become resistant to that. We come up with a new drug again, but we're running out of jumps to make in the game of leapfrog, and they are winning.
So what's the biology behind how or why that happens? Is there
really
a layman's way of explaining that?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are a number of different mechanisms, but the underlying reality is this. Since long before humans arrived, bacteria made compounds that they aimed against each other as sort of low-level biological weapons in order to clear out space for their descendants to compete for sources of nutrition. We took those compounds that bacteria make, such as the compound penicillin, and we took them into the laboratory and we made synthesized and better and more complex versions of them, and we called them antibiotics. But since bacteria had been learning to defend against each other's weapons back in prehistory, they learned to defend against our weapons aimed at them as well. And so as that game of leapfrog started, we would put forth a compound. Bacteria would, by just the random magic of natural selection, find ways to defend themselves against the effect of that compound, which might be a way of exploding the bacterial wall or breaking up the DNA within the bacterial envelope, a number of different ways that these compounds work. But they would find ways to defend themselves against it, and so the drug would no longer work, and then we'd have to come up with a new drug. The problem now is that bacteria's inventiveness has not diminished, but we, for various reasons, are running out of drugs.
And that's one of the problems that I think you talk about, is that when it comes to the pharmaceutical companies, we're not really getting the same numbers of new drugs that we used to get to fight off this bacteria.
That's right. The crisis in antibiotic resistance has a number of factors within it, from misbehavior in medicine to inappropriate use in agriculture. But another part of that, another factor in how we got here, is that from a pharmaceutical company's point of view, making antibiotics doesn't actually make a lot of sense. And here's why I say that. It's generally accepted that to make a truly new drug costs about $1 billion and at least 10 years of research and development, sometimes more. Imagine that you've expended that time and money and you have a new compound that you're going to put on the market. Since bacteria respond immediately to any new chemical weapon, essentially, they'll immediately begin adapting. Within a certain point, there will be resistance. Within a certain point after that, there will be enough resistance extant that physicians will start to think, perhaps I shouldn't use this drug. Perhaps my patient will have an infection that's resistant to it, and my patient will get sicker instead of getting better. At that point, which is usually only a couple of years down the road, the drug ceases to earn back the investment that the pharmaceutical company put into it. Antibiotics have turned out, in pharmaceutical companies' points of view, to not be a worthwhile investment. And as a result, there's now very active policy discussions as to what should be done to lure them back into that manufacturing space again.
Well, you mentioned agriculture. Let's talk about the discovery that biologists made not too long after Fleming accepted the Nobel Prize, the connection between tetracycline and livestock and animal growth.
This is really an extraordinary story. And until I started looking into it for this new book, I didn't know that it actually went back to the very beginning of the antibiotic era, but it does. So To make this make sense, you have to think about sort of where we were as a society at the end of World War II. So World War II happens. It's a massive military mobilization all across the world. Very many people go into the armed forces, and there's a huge surge of things that are necessary to support those armed forces, which is not just materiel and housing and ammunition and boats, but also food. So there's a huge expansion of infrastructure in producing food, particularly protein, particularly animal protein, especially in the United States, but in all the combatants around the world. And then the war ends, and all of that infrastructure still exists, but the guaranteed market has gone away. So meat production turns to looking for cheaper ways to produce the same amount of protein that they still have been producing, and they start using cheaper forms of feed. But the cheaper feed doesn't have as much nutrition in it, and production rates go down. So people start looking in sort of agricultural veterinary circles for what can they do to keep animals healthy so that they'll eventually become healthy meat while not spending as much money feeding them. And there are all kinds of things tried. So it happens that at Letterly Laboratories, which is a division of American Cyanamid, two chemists who are working on the manufacture of tetracycline, which is another early antibiotic after penicillin, after streptomycin, but still early on in the antibiotic era, decide to take the residue left over from making the first tetracycline, chlortetracycline, and feed it to a bunch of chickens, actually. And they weigh the chickens and discover that the chickens that received these antibiotic residues, which are effectively sort of a carbohydrate mash, got fat faster than chickens that did not, than the control group. They later figure out that what's going on is that micro doses of the tetracycline are left in this leftover carbohydrate. And from that discovery, a worldwide industry is born. That's really the impetus for what we think of as now as modern concentrated meat production, because giving those micro doses, which later come to be called growth promoters, allow animals to move faster through the production chain of agriculture. So for the same amount of feed, you can get them to market faster, or for lesser feed, you can get them up to the weight that you would have expected if you were feeding them more without the drug. Mm-hmm. Out of that comes what we think of as the extraordinary amount of meat for relatively inexpensive prices that we can now produce in the West, but it also starts moving the chain of the development of resistance on the agricultural side that's already been perceived in the human medicine side.
You're listening to author and journalist Maren McKenna, and we're talking about the growing threat to human health posed by antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And I assume this has something to do with why or how agriculture has moved to these large feeding operations. You obviously can protect the animals with these antibiotics, and therefore these closely confined settings allow farming to get by with it.
Right. So if you look at meat production these days in the United States, there's really three different reasons why antibiotics are used, and they're on a sort of mushy continuum. The first and most obvious is that farmers use antibiotics when animals are sick or when there's a disease in their herd. That's treatment for a disease. That's a completely legitimate use for antibiotics. No one that I know of argues with that. Now, if you're an organic farmer and you've committed to not using antibiotics and you have a sick animal, then you might treat the animal and no longer be able to consider them organic. But no one says that animals should suffer. I think that's important to say. But the other two uses are on the opposite end of the spectrum from treatment, is these growth promoters, or as they're sometimes now called, subtherapeutic dosing, which is really micro doses of antibiotics given to encourage that weight increase, which is actually an increase in muscle mass for the most part, faster than would happen naturally. And then in between those two extremes of growth promotion on the one end and full therapeutic dosing on the other, there's a kind of mushy middle category, which is called disease prevention and control. And what that is dosing animals routinely with antibiotics in their feed or in their water, not so much for growth promotion and not so much because they are sick, but because the conditions of feedlots, for instance, or very concentrated hog farms or very concentrated chicken houses allow disease to spread. And using antibiotics routinely keeps those diseases down.
And there's also a problem with the low doses that they're given, isn't there, in the sense that you might be knocking off some but not all of the bacteria?
Right, exactly. So if you go to a physician and you get a prescription yourself, you'll almost always hear the instruction to make sure that you finish the prescription.
That's right.
Your doctor will say, you're going to start feeling good about day 4, but I'm giving you antibiotics for 10 days and I want you to take all of them. Here's why they say that. It's because all of the bacteria that are in the infection that is making you sick are not of equal strength. They're going to have slightly different genetic differences. They're going to be slightly more strong or slightly more weak because as bacteria reproduce, they make slight sort of copying errors in their genetic codes that make them all very different. So it might be that within that population of bacteria that's causing this infection, some of them are slightly more or slightly less vulnerable to the antibiotic that you're given that's intended to kill them. So some of them will be killed right away as soon as you start taking that drug, and that's why you start to feel better. But it takes the full 10 days to make sure that that entire population of bacteria, that, you know, everything is wiped out so that, that you really are well. It's so that not just the weak have died, but also the strong have died too. What happens in antibiotic use in agriculture, the weak die, but the strong survive and grow back into the living space that's just been left in that animal system as a result of some of those bacteria dying. So the thing that our physicians tell us not to do, that's the thing that accidentally and without meaning to, agriculture does all the time.
And so the ultimate result of that is the superbug?
Yes. When we say superbug, what generally speaking, what we mean is bacteria that have become resistant to at least some drugs. And sometimes it's a few drugs, and sometimes it's a lot of drugs. And there are superbugs that exist only as a result of antibiotic misuse in medicine. There's a type of very resistant organism that the Centers for Disease Control, for instance, talks a lot about these days. The acronym for it is CRE, and it's a problem, particularly in intensive care units. Now, CREs have nothing to do with agriculture. They really are due to antibiotic misuse or incorrect use in medicine. However, there's another completely separate category of superbugs that are becoming enumerated all the time that are really directly traceable back to antibiotic use in agriculture. And we know that that's the case because as genetic analysis tools become more and more sophisticated, we can actually look into the genetic code of the resistant bacterium and trace it back to particular antibiotic uses in particular settings. Farm antibiotic use, when it's not done appropriately or when it's done without attention to the unintended consequences, really can cause human illness that then moves through the human population so quickly that we kind of forget where it came from to start with.
Well, and where it ends up is very interesting. I believe you cite a Flagstaff, Arizona supermarket study that discovers some very interesting things.
Right. So this is when I say, you know, sort of the black box of this transaction is opening. This is the kind of thing I'm thinking about that, you know, if you think about the meat that all of us buy, it's an enormous economy. And the foodborne illness outbreaks that happen all the time illustrate how difficult it is to trace a piece of meat on your plate or in your freezer back to an individual supermarket, back to an individual farm. So it's always been kind of confusing and hard to tease out exactly where superbugs that have a farm connection are coming from. But there's a couple of really innovative researchers who have started to use cutting-edge genetic tools to try to figure out this bacterial traffic. And this project in Flagstaff is one of them. There's been another one in Minneapolis-St. Paul as well, and now there's a couple in different places around the country, where what they've done is they have gone to just random everyday supermarkets, and they've taken meat out of the case, the same meat that you or I might buy if we were shopping in that store in that town. And then they look for resistant organisms on the meat. Then they've gone elsewhere in the city. In the case of the Minneapolis-St. Paul study, they went to the VA hospital and checked for samples from the microbiological lab in this hospital to see if there are any similar resistant bugs. And through that genetic analysis, they can say, oh, look, this meat is being sold in this town, and it has this resistance profile. And here are people in the same town having no connection to this supermarket who have the same resistance profile in the resistant bugs making them sick. Doesn't it seem likely that these are connected? And those analyses are getting more and more precise and doing more and more to sort of illuminate that path backward to the farm.
You're listening to Maren McKenna. She's an author and journalist whose research and writing deals with the growing threat to human health posed by antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Well, it looks to me from reading your articles that on the one side you have the agriculture issues, on the other side you have the overprescribing of antibiotics in the medical community, and it's not really just a issue with the medical practitioner, but mothers and fathers who are taking kids into the doctor and in many cases just either demanding or assuming that the doctor's going to lay an antibiotic on them. And I think I've read that maybe 80% of upper respiratory illnesses are viral, not bacteria related. So you're taking these things and it really doesn't have any relation to the problem. And I guess what I'm getting at is the finger pointing that's involved here.
So it's important, because this is such a big problem, you know, it's important to say that really we are all complicit. This is not necessarily something that was done to us. Whether we knew it or not, we all participated. And, you know, the ways in which we participate are we expect cheeseburgers to cost a dollar. And we expect or need because of our jobs for our kids to be able we want our kids not to be sick. We want to go to the doctor and know that something has happened that is going to make our child better. And it's just sort of our cultural thing that we feel that when we go to a physician's office, if we think we have an infection, what tells us that we had a successful encounter with that physician is that we got a prescription at the end. Somehow being told, watch that infection for 3 days and then maybe I'll write you a prescription, doesn't feel as satisfying. Now, it's also important to say, you know, we live in a country where a lot of people don't have access to paid sick leave at their jobs. So if you are a parent who's working that kind of job, where maybe it's an hourly paid job, it's a job at a big box store or a 7-Eleven or something like that, or alternatively, a job in a small startup business where they don't have good insurance, and you wake up and your child has an ear infection, and you need to get your child into daycare so that you can get to your job where you don't have paid sick leave, and the daycare is going to say to you, if your child is not already on antibiotics, then your child cannot come to daycare today. That's a very good reason to pressure your doc to give you an antibiotic prescription. So no one does this out of intention to kill the world. You know, there are very good reasons why all of these inputs into this incredibly complex system happen, whether it's inexpensive protein, or whether it's people needing to get to their jobs, whether it's physicians being under pressure to finish that appointment and move on to the next one, whether it's hospitalists feeling like they're going to be sued if they don't do everything that seems obvious for a patient. But the reality is that all of those things, any one of those things might just be a slow drip, but all of them combine to bring us to this crisis where we really are at the edge of a post-antibiotic era where the drugs just won't work anymore.
You know, I think it was in Dr. Blaser's book, Missing Microbes, that he said in late 2013, the FDA announced it will take the first steps in removing growth-promoting antibiotics from our livestock. First of all, that sounds like a move in the right direction, but a gargantuan chore. But I just thought I'd check with you on whether or not the FDA has the stomach for this. Maybe that's
not
the right word.
Well, it's an open question. In Europe, not only is there very good data on antibiotic use, but there are very tight controls on antibiotic use. In 2006, the European Union simply banned all growth promoter uses. So those microdoses that make animals put on muscle weight, those are not allowed to be used anymore. They've had a struggle with the mushy middle category called disease prevention and control, and some countries have actually clamped down on that and some have not. So since about 1977 in the United States, people have been pushing for a similar ban. In fact, the FDA actually put forward the idea in what's called a notice of opportunity for a hearing in the Federal Register in 1977. And Congress got into the act and multiple times prevented the FDA from actually enacting such a ban. So back a couple of years ago, the FDA essentially threw up its hands and said, we're never going to get anywhere with regulation. Let us instead create a voluntary program. So that's what they did last December, December 2013. They enacted a voluntary ban on growth promoter antibiotic use, and they aimed it not at farmers, but at the veterinary pharmaceutical manufacturers, the people who make the antibiotics, telling them, or asking them rather, that the indication, the thing on the label of a drug that says you can use this for growth promotion, should be taken off the label. So people are watching this FDA move in the United States and really wondering, are the companies really going to fall in line? Will we really get to reduction of growth promoter use 30 plus years after the FDA first tried it? Or is it just going to be sort of a shell game where things just move under a different label, but nothing really changes?
Well, Marin, thanks to the good work that you've done and others who are highlighting this issue, especially the issue of the use of antibiotics in farming and the extent to which they wind up in our meat, it seems to me that grocers and consumers could have some impact here. I believe we've seen in recent years a number of grocers rise up where you can go to the meat counter and rest assured that you're going to get a piece of meat that is completely free of any antibiotic.
That's right. And it really is, I think, going to be consumer pressure that turns the tide on this. And it's so interesting to me to see that, for instance, almost all the major companies producing poultry now have antibiotic-free lines. They sell, whether it's Perdue or Tyson or Golden Plump, they have a division within their corporations that produces antibiotic-free chicken. They are doing it because their consumers have told them that's what they want to eat. That, to me, is the sign of a consumer movement really going somewhere. And that, to me, signals that people are looking at this in a different way.
Well, we have time for one more question, and I wish it could be a more upbeat answer. But I do really have to ask you what the scary alternative is. The post-antibiotic era, as I think you and others have referred to it, how it would dramatically impact our health and our everyday life. I mean, it just seems to take us back to a time before the discovery of penicillin.
You're exactly right. This is the point at which I keep everybody up at night.
Right.
So I don't think we realize, because almost all of us, you know, have only lived within the antibiotic era, we don't understand the way in which antibiotics really changed the world. You know, you might think that your grandmother perhaps used to really be obsessional about how if you were outside playing and you scratched yourself, that they would insist that you scrubbed with soap and water. And we'd sort of laugh at them because, you know, how dangerous was a scratch? Well, the first human to receive penicillin experimentally was a British constable named Alexander. And he scratched his face on a rosebush in his garden and got such a serious staph infection that eventually he died of it. He got enough penicillin to make him a little better, but then they ran out of the drug. And the accounts of how sick he was, they're really horrific. So antibiotics now underpin so much of what we take for granted in our modern lives, not just cancer care, not just organ transplants, not just joint transplants. None of those could happen if people who received those transplants didn't get antibiotics routinely. But without antibiotics, we couldn't do open cavity surgery. We couldn't do abdominal surgery. We couldn't do heart surgery. We couldn't have safe childbirth. The most conservative numbers are that 5 out of every 1,000 women died in childbirth of infection before antibiotics came along. We obviously couldn't have the things we take for granted, like liposuction and plastic surgery and tattoos and things like that. But think of all the things that children now do that would have been riskier. Would you let your kid slide into home plate or climb a tree and maybe break a bone? I wouldn't if I didn't know that they were protected from infection. So things like that, things like trauma care, like having a massive car accident on the incredibly fast highway not far from my house here in Atlanta, that becomes chancy. Living your everyday life becomes chancy. Having a child becomes chancy. And not only does meat production become more difficult, but so does farmed fish, which routinely uses antibiotics, and farmed shrimp, which in other countries use antibiotics, and a significant portion of the fruit we now eat relies on antibiotic use as well. And there, too, antibiotic-resistant diseases are starting to show up, most notably in apples and pears. So there are signs all around that this trust that we've put in antibiotics to hold up the structure of modern society ought to start fraying, because the protection of antibiotics is starting to fray. And we have a limited amount of time to restore this before we're really out of time.
Maren McKenna, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. And let me remind my listeners that among Maren McKenna's writings, there's an article that really is a discussion of what she's just summed up here, Imagining the Post-Antibiotics Future, by Maren McKenna. Thanks again, Maren.
Thank you for having me.
Next week, David Robertson, author of Brick by Brick, How Lego Rewrote the Rules of Innovation and Conquered the Global Toy Industry. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.